chapters 9 and 10. So, chapter 9, the Island of the Voices. Let's recap briefly again. the last chapters that we read, we found out how Eustace's adventure as a dragon ended, mm-hmm. which briefly stated was how.
Aslan
baptized.
Baptizing.
That was it. From our own dragonish nature. Eustace is baptized and becomes
a better person.
Becomes a better person. Becomes a real boy and becomes a better person. It's not perfect. He is continuing to work out his salvation with fear and trembling, but he's definitely better than he was before, and there was a change. There was a transformation, not just on the outside with this enchanted dragon form, but in his heart and in his soul. Watch them have another narrow escape, a couple of narrow escapes. The first with the sea serpent that nearly tore up the boat. And the second with an island, which they first called Goldwater. Why?
Because anything that touched that water, any of them would turn to gold.
They have renamed it by the time they leave to what?
Dead water.
Death water. Why?
Because if you turn to gold completely, that's the end of you.
You're dead. Yeah, right.
You're a statue.
That's right. So, in kind of a King Midas style story, the terrible downfall of what such an enchantment could do, it could rob you of your life. But even beyond that, the gold fever, the greed that starts to overpower them, and they can feel that this is a place whose enchantments are wicked. Isn't that kind of like sin, though? The enticements from a distance seem worthwhile. You know, we don't fall into sin because it looks terrible and painful and bad. We fall into sin because there's something about it that's very attractive. The problem with it, just like the water that turns to gold, is it leads not to wealth, it leads to death. We think that by pursuing this sin, we're going to get ahead somehow, we're going to feel pleasure somehow, we will like it somehow, but instead, following sin like that does not lead to our benefit. It leads to our deaths.
Thomas Aquinas points out that there has to be something attractive in sin, or you wouldn't turn towards it.
That's right.
That's the way our will works. We are attracted to a good thing, and we perceive the good thing in the sin and turn towards it.
That's right. And neglecting the risks and the dangers
that goes with it.
That go with it, and that, you know, basically overpower it. You know, from the outside in, or at first glance, first blush, looks good, turns out it is quite bitter indeed. Okay, so.
Well, they found one more lord.
That's right.
With gold.
So, you know, slowly but surely we're ticking off these lords who have been lost. That last one they found at the bottom of the golden pool. Probably jumped in to cool himself off because they found his clothing and his armor and everything else. He looked like he was just a perfect golden statue, but that seems to be his terrible fate. So they leave the island of Deathwater, which is a point of mercy to others. Remember that these are uncharted, and so they are actually creating the chart that others might use as they go. If they put it as gold water, people would want to show up, and then they would suffer for it. You call it death water, and people will keep a wide berth. And for their own sakes, they give it an unpalatable name so that no one will be tempted with that sort of misery like they were. So they've now left, and they are back onto
sailing.
So How do we start off in chapter 9? They're sailing and what?
They're sailing due west. Directly into the sun,
directly
actually.
Directly into the sun?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, what about the sun?
The sun seems to get bigger.
It seems like it's getting a little bigger. Now, some people think, eh, and some people think, yeah, but there's just enough that as they sail continually on, there seems to be something happening. Now, what is the sea voyage like?
And they're not seeing land, and
right.
Their supplies are getting low.
That's right. If anything, it's very, very empty. They don't see fish. They don't see birds.
They don't see anything.
They don't see anything. Now, it's not
just sea.
It's not the trouble like they had before. It's not about terrible storms. It's not about sea serpents. It's just
peaceful.
It's peaceful. But what happens when you have day after day after day after that?
Well, as the supplies go down, especially the way they were, they calculated how many days of supplies they had, and after that they had to turn back.
That's right. That's right. So what happens as they continue east and find out that they are right at the tail end? If we don't see land right now, we're gonna have to turn around, otherwise we might not make it back. So what happens?
They do.
They see land. Nice wide bay where they are able to anchor, and a party of them rows ashore. What is this island like?
Beautiful. Like a well-kept garden.
Like a well-kept garden. So it's a different kind of beauty. They've seen kind of a lush tropical beauty, but this is different. This is more like the beauty of a garden, of a formal
English garden.
There's a lawn that looks tended. There's a beach where there are no weeds. There are trees that are, you know, in certain places. It is a place of order, a place of design, a place of purpose, a place of care. But what else about it?
There aren't any people.
Mm-hmm. Nobody's there. It seems dead empty. what do they note a far way away as they're walking through this garden-y area?
There's a house.
Okay. So is this an inhabited island?
Well,
looks to be.
Sure seems that way. You know, so there's kind of a mystery starting off with that. You would be in an island that is obviously meticulously kept. You know, if you don't mow for a while, the grass goes crazy. If you don't weed for a while, the weeds take over. You know, English gardens, a formal English garden, takes a ton of care. So, where is everybody? How odd. There's even a house, a large house. But everything seems almost preternaturally quiet. Where is everyone? So, what happens with Lucy?
She gets a little stone in her shoe and decides to take it out, and then finds a knot in her shoe, so...
The simplest of things.
Yeah.
It's the simplest of things. You can't plan for it. She didn't think through it. You know, oh, I got a stone in my shoe. I'm just going to kind of sit down for a minute and take care of it. Everybody else keeps walking off towards the house, and suddenly she finds herself all alone. And then what happens?
She hears something. Thump, thump, thump.
Okay. Heavy thumps, as though someone was smacking the ground with a giant mallet. And that's got to be disconcerting enough to hear these heavy thumps getting closer and closer and closer. But what really sets her off?
She hears a voice.
Where's this voice coming from?
God knows.
No idea. No, she sees no one. But there is a voice, and then what else?
There has a plot.
There's a chorus.
There's a response. There's a response from lots of voices.
Yeah.
So you have a lead voice, and you have these supporting voices. And what does Lucy overhear?
A plot.
Okay.
A they're going to go and station themselves between the ship and the party that is investigating.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure they cannot return to their ship.
All right. Well, how would you relate how the main voice and the supporting voices kind of interact?
Well, there's the main voice is obviously in charge.
Okay.
And the others keep echoing him in a very positive.
It makes me think of the ancient plays.
Okay. Like a Greek chorus?
Where they had a good chorus.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
I will say they seem much dumber than
but
a Greek chorus.
But dumber
than a chorus. They seem like idiotic sycophants. There's a great, and I think these are Looney Tunes rather than part of the Tom and Jerry universe. But I'm thinking of a series of cartoons where you've got this big bulldog and a little dog next to him, and the big bulldog, he's kind of walking around and strutting his stuff, and the little bulldog's like, yeah, what do you want to do, Spike? What do you want to do, Spike?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you've got the boss, and then you've got all of these other voices that are like, yeah, whatever you say, boss. Oh, what a great idea. Like, everything that the chief says is, you know, that's a great idea. That's the best idea you've ever had. No one could argue with that. And so you've got these kind of idiot responses, but as silly as it might sound, this plan is actually quite serious. Mm. What is so serious about it? What's so serious about these voices, which don't sound very bright, getting in the way of the party coming back to the boat?
Well, when you have an invisible enemy,
it's a little difficult. So the fact that they are invisible, we don't know how big they are. We don't know how many they are. We don't know how well armed they are.
That's right.
And how do you defend yourself against someone you can't see? What if they're right behind you right now? Oh my gosh! No, there's no idea. But that's the idea, is that an invisible enemy seems impossible to defend against. So, what does Lucy do with this information?
She brings it to Caspian.
Okay. And this little group decides to do what?
Go back.
Okay, we're going to go back and we're together, mm-hmm. very carefully, well prepared, to see what it is that is happening here. We're not going to stumble into it, so you've given us a heads up. But we also don't really know what's happening, so we're going to stick together. We're going to be kind of in a defensive formation, and they're going to head back to the boat. So what happens?
I love Rick Chief's comment. He always...
The very first thing he says is what?
Wonder if they become visible when you drive a sword into them.
Yeah, only Reaper Chief would.
With the gas like that.
Exactly.
All right. So, they are really stuck here. There's no good place for the Dawn Treader to anchor anywhere else that they could get to. And even this thought of kind of sneaking away to the other side and maybe swimming across is. It's not a workable plan, because if these guys are invisible, they could be here right now. Mm-hmm. They could be listening to us for all we know.
Yeah.
The only thing we can really do is to stand together and to just face it head on and see what we'll see. So they do. They make it down back to the shoreline, and they are indeed confronted with these invisible, mysterious voices. And what do the voices demand?
Well, they want Lucy to do something for them.
That's right. You've got a young girl with you, and we made ourselves a promise that if there was ever a party that had a young girl, we would not let them leave until she did this task for us. Now, that sounds kind of ominous.
Mm.
So you've got to think that the initial response is going to be no way. You know, we're not going to put this young queen in danger. But what actually happens with this?
Well, Lucy stands up for herself and says, yeah, I'm going to do it.
Okay. Now, what is her rationale?
Well, if it's going to make them visible, for one thing.
Okay.
That will be easier.
Well, you know, if we're facing death, I would rather give ourselves a chance to survive than just be slaughtered on the beach. You know, if my life is in danger, which it clearly is, against an invisible enemy who is armed. They prove that they're armed. Someone throws a spear and it strikes a tree or something,
yeah.
And it's visible as soon as they let go of it. So there's a bunch of them and they're armed. You have to assume that this would be a fight to the death. And there would really seem no reason to believe why you would win. So if I'm going to die, Lucy wants to take her fate in her own hands. At least give ourselves a chance. Surprisingly, who supports her?
I forget who it was.
It's Rinpoche.
Oh,
of all the people you would think would be quite content to lead a glorious charge into doom and death, and he basically says, no, the queen is right. This is an act of you know, she's being valiant in this, and she is also being wise. Her words make sense. This is not a fight we can win. We cannot defend her anyway. Therefore, allow her to do this, which frankly would be a noble act. And at that point, everyone else is like, well, gosh, if Rinpoche doesn't want to fight, then this must be the only way to go. So, are we still terrified of these voices?
They don't seem to be as afraid anymore.
Yeah, they... Again, they seem to be rather simple-minded. And they don't seem to be belligerent so much as...
They just want this little girl to go and change the...
Yeah, so what's their story? What is their story?
There's a magic book.
Okay.
They want her to go and find the formula in the book that will make them visible.
Okay.
Because...
Is why are they invisible?
The chief's little girl. They were made ugly.
They were made ugly by whom?
The magician.
Ah, there's a magician on the island.
Right.
And they were his servants.
Yeah.
He got mad because they say he wanted him to do something and they didn't want to do it. And how did he take his revenge on them?
Yeah, well, put a smell on him.
To be ugly.
And they didn't want to look at each other.
They were so ugly, we can't stand it
invisible.
Anymore.
So they sent the chief's little girl went up and went to the magic book and she pronounced the spell to make them invisible.
Okay, so now they wouldn't have to look at how ugly they were.
Right.
So what's the problem?
They're tired of being invisible.
You know what, after a while they just decided they wanted this is enough. Enough's enough. Now why a little girl? Why did the chief's daughter, first of all, do the spell, and why are they interested in Lucy so much?
Is there the sense of purity in a little girl?
Not sure. That makes as much sense as anything.
Yeah.
But there seems to be some kind of enchantment that only the magician himself
or a little girl
is able to use this spell book.
And where are they?
While
this is going on, what happened to the magician and the little girl?
The little girl became invisible too because she was the chief's daughter.
That's right. And this might not be all of these creatures. They're, you know, maybe they've got a settlement or something someplace else, and this is just like a little fighting force. But no one's seen the magician for a long time. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he's gone. Maybe he's invisible too. We don't know. So,
but thank God, I mean, Lucy asked, do I have to do this at night?
Oh, yeah. No, no way. Oh, that'd be terrible.
Yeah.
So, she agrees to do it, and how do they treat them out? How do these invisible creatures treat them after that?
Give them a dinner.
They actually seem a rather decent sort. And even when they say, well, if you didn't do this, we're going to have to kill you, it was all, you know, this is nothing personal.
Yeah.
This is just business because we need to get this task done.
But then at dinner was a disaster. They don't know if these are leaping frogs or bugs or what, because they bring the plates
that's
up
right.
in the air, then they come back down.
All of the stuff comes way up and then way down, then way up and then way down. It's splishing and splashing everywhere and making a great old mess. And yet, these invisible creatures still seem quite of good cheer, and the idiotic repeating is still going on. Oh, best idea you've ever had. Oh, you've got that all right. And as a matter of fact, they start saying stuff to each other that just seems so pointless in its idiocy.
Oh, yeah, that water is wet.
Yeah, water is wet, and there's nothing like food when you're hungry. Okay. When it's nighttime, it's awfully dark. Yep, mm-hmm, whatever. So, they seem to spend the night with a little incident, and Lucy wakes up in the morning. What's her state of mind in the morning?
She's ready, but she's a bit apprehensive.
Yeah.
Day of an examination.
That's right. She's anxious.
Day of the dentist.
It's like, you know, you're going to go to the dentist, you're going to have a test.
Yes.
So she's resolved, but she's also a little anxious.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't sound like fun.
So,
evidently they told her where it was.
Yes. So there's an explanation. You're going to have to go upstairs. You're going to have to go to the end of the hallway, and you'll know.
See the grandfather clock.
Yeah, you'll know when you see it. So she does make it into the magician's house, and how might you describe it? Creepy.
Yeah. There are signs or some types of things written on the.
There's writing she doesn't understand. There are these oddball masks that have holes where the eyes are. They're just kind of disconcerting.
But I think the funnest thing is when she scares herself.
She scares herself how?
Well, there's a mirror that has hair at the top and a beard.
And glass, which is just this bizarre little point. How do these things strike you so far? Sinister?
No, comical.
Kind of comical.
Yeah.
What do you think? Masks without these eyes. She doesn't describe the masks themselves as being
scary
ugly or evil, just disconcerting.
Mm-hmm.
Which, frankly, you're in this completely
different,
you know, unusual circumstance and the anxiety and everything else. But so far, it doesn't seem sinister. It just, any anxiety or worry she has is because of the unknown nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, everything described seems pretty benign, if not actually silly. So, she makes it into the library, and what does she see?
What do the books there?
All sorts of books.
All kinds of
books. An enormous library with beautiful books and giant books and everything else. How does she find the spell book she wants?
Well, it's sitting on a stand in the middle of a room. You can't miss it.
Can't miss it. Bigger than a church Bible, and it's right there. So she approaches the book, and she goes to read. And this is a kind of an interesting experience, so let's sort of look at it for a bit.
I think the worst thing is that when she's standing at the book, the door is open, she can't shut it.
That's right.
And, I mean, when you're doing something you're not sure that you should be doing...
You don't want an open door behind you.
You don't want an open door behind you.
Who's standing in the doorway?
Right. But she can't shut it, so it is what it is.
That's right.
So, she goes to open the book, initially it won't open, but it's just got clasps, so she opens that up, and what happens when she touches it?
Tingling.
Yeah, like electricity. Mm-hmm. This is a magic book, and already she's getting some sort of sense of its magic. So what is it like, just in a general sense, she opens it up, and how does this book strike her?
It's not printed. It's
okay.
Written, like, made me think, Old English or something.
Okay.
Manuscript writing.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm kind of thinking like...
those wonderful books with the...
Like Lindisfarne or the Book of Kells or something like that.
Right.
You know, like these Irish monks used to not only write scripture by hand, but also illuminate with all these drawings and all these other things about it. That's kind of how it strikes me too. There's drawings and there's writings, and it's a very firm, pleasing script. Does this book seem sinister?
No. It was crisp and smooth and had a nice smell.
You know, we think of spell books, and maybe you think of like a cackling witch and a bubbling cauldron and a very sinister book that has, you know, very angular writing, or it's written in blood, or, you know, something kind of sinister about the book itself. But this, this seems to be beautiful, and it seems to be just really, really pleasant. Not even pleasing in the sense of enticing, but just
beautiful,
just beautiful and nice and good. This book seems good. So,
think of the Bible.
Aha! So, what sort of spells is she finding? Again, we think of spells, and we might think of these very, you know, creepy things.
Warts, toothache, cramp.
Yeah, these all seem very, very simple and very, you know, kind of folk remedy-ish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to get rid of warts, and you're going to heal a toothache. And
how do you prevent snow or fog?
These all seem kind of like nice things. So
that's something I wanted to ask you.
Yes,
because this bothered me. I do not know what the reference is to. How to produce enchanted sleeps, and how to give a man an ass's head, as they did to poor Bottom. Whose
uh-huh.
Bottom?
From Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh.
Who was given the head of who was given the head of an ass?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a Shakespearean reference.
Okay.
The longer she read, the more wonderful and the more real the pictures became. Mm. Now, after going through these very simple things and very kind of ordinary and happy things, she comes across one that really catches her eye. What is it?
An infallible spell to make beautiful her that uttereth it beyond the lot of mortals.
Uh-huh.
That's quite a temptation.
It is. Now, what is the picture of?
Her.
It's a picture of her looking in a book and saying things. The picture seems so real, it's like it's moving. Or maybe it is. But whatever's happening, this is not just words on a page any longer. It's drawing her in.
Mm.
You know, whether it's an enchantment of the page or her imagination or some sort of working of very deep magic, she is seeing the effects of what's going to happen when she personally, Lucy Pevensie, says this spell. However the book knows, it's showing her. What does she see?
Well, she sees herself being revered.
Right.
That people fall all over her.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are also fights.
That's right.
About who's going to.
She sees this dazzling beauty, but she can tell somehow that it's herself. There's enough recognizable, but it's a beauty that causes knights and kings and dukes to fight over her and even destroy their own lands
for the
sake of her beauty.
Susan's always been thought the beauty of the family.
Right.
And with Lucy being more beautiful, Susan develops some jealousy, and there is a fraction in the family. So she must be seeing that this particular spell is not very healthy.
There's kind of a Helen of Troy aspect of this, that a beauty that's so remarkable that it causes destruction because people must possess it.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts seeing, the last things about this is seeing Susan kind of put in her place. You know, everyone always wants to talk about how pretty Susan is. Well, won't she be jealous when she sees how beautiful I will become? And that's enough to make Lucy say, you know what? I'm going to do it. But what happens?
When she opens the book, there's the figure of Aslan.
Aslan is there now.
And he's growling.
Growling. She can see teeth. She knows that this is a growl of warning, of disappointment, maybe even of anger. Why would Aslan be angry at her?
Disappointed in the way she's thinking about
doing it.
All these different things that she predicted.
Yes. This would be a very selfish act. If you look at her rationale, it is, I can put my older sister in her place. I can have people fight over me. you know, this is a self-centered thing to do, very selfish, and not like Lucy at all, fraught with all sorts of danger and destruction, and it takes the face of Aslan to remind her that, it kind of snap her out of it. So she turns the page and
so
can't do it.
When you're besieged with heavy temptation, you turn towards the Lord.
That's right. That's right.
Oh gosh.
And then it is his face that brings her back to sensibility and reality. So what's the next spell she encounters?
Picture of a third class carriage.
Okay. It's a spell to know what your friends
think about you.
Now, this doesn't seem as dramatic as being a beauty beyond all mortal comparison. This seems very small and very simple. And so, what is her perspective on saying it or not?
She thinks it's neat. She's going to find out what they really think.
That's right. And
that's
and interestingly enough, it's she kind of justifies it by saying, well, I didn't say that. It's almost like a reward. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll treat myself because I didn't do this terrible thing. I'll do this other one instead. And, you know, surely people would realize that, you know, this is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a self-justification here. Is it our right to know what other people think?
No, I don't think so.
Especially, and these aren't strangers. Who is it that you're going to learn what they think?
Her good friends.
Your friends. It even says that in the title. And so she convinces herself that it's okay for her to do this. And so what does she see?
Conversation between the two, and one of them ends up saying, I've got more sense than that. She's not a bad little kid in her way, but I was getting pretty tired of her before the end of the term. Which,
so she hears.
That's her best friend saying, I was tired of her.
Yeah, so here is her best friend being questioned by another girl saying, mm-hmm. You're not going to bother with that old Lucy again, are you? And this, her Lucy's friend, basically dismisses Lucy.
Yeah.
And how does that affect Lucy?
Two faces of beast.
She is hurt. She's angry.
Sure.
And you know,
she says, I did so much for her.
And basically says, well, you're not gonna get the chance to be my friend the next term. This has broken their relationship. And so, in tears now, she goes to
the next page.
And what is the next page?
A beautiful story.
A beautiful story. Now, what is the story for? There's an intent. It's a spell. Now, the spell reads like a story, but what is the title of the spell itself?
Is there a title?
Mm-hmm. For the refreshment of the spirit.
Okay.
So she starts reading it. And the story feels real, the pictures feel real, and it immerses her into a story of unspeakable beauty and peace and joy. What happens when she gets to the end of it?
She doesn't remember it.
It starts to fade. Well, how do you fix that?
She's going to read it over again.
Read it over again.
But you can't feel the page.
You can't do it.
You can't go backwards. You cannot go backwards. And all of a sudden, it starts getting very, very, very fuzzy. What does she remember out of it?
Nothing.
Just little snatches and pieces.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A cup and a sword and a tree and a green hill, but she can't remember anything else. But it makes such an impression on her. The next line even says that for the rest of her life, whenever she said something was a good story, it's because it reminded her of the one story that she read and has forgotten. C.S. Lewis, in one of his very famous passages, talks about the nature of joy, which he connects to this German word, Sehnsucht, which means longing. And he has this reference about, it's this longing for something that we cannot articulate. We feel like we've been built for it, but we don't know what it is. We get snatches and glimpses, and it's like it's on the tip of our tongue, but it feels like news from a country we have never visited. It feels like a tune that we know but we've never heard. It's basically being built to be in God's presence, to be built for heaven. And this mortal life gives us little tastes of it. But it's really, those moments that feel the best, it's because they're connecting us to what we're truly designed for, which is not this, it is that. Our souls are restless till we find our rest in thee.
Saving us.
And so, it is that longing, which is joy. And it sounds like she has encountered a story that has connected her to that ultimate and eternal purpose for which she has been created. If we had to guess, what do you think the story is?
Probably the story of the redemption and the passage into heaven.
Yeah, I think that this is a gospel story. Mm-hmm. Now, Lewis will also write that the gospel is a story in the sense of it is the great story, capital G, capital S. It is the story that you find echoes and snatches of in every other culture because we were built for it. And this is like kind of how we talked about before in the first book with, you know, the fauns and the satyrs and Father Christmas and all these other myths from a variety of places finding their fulfillment within Narnia and through Aslan. That the gospel itself is the great myth, meaning a myth is simply a story that seeks to explain reality. So it happens that this myth is true, and all the other myths are like echoes and shadows of it. That every culture and every time and every place has some little piece, like it's reaching out, trying to understand and grasping just a small bit of it. But this is the story of human nature because we have been built by God and for God. Therefore, this is not just his story, but it's ours. And though it can be told in a variety of ways, it always comes back to this. and so I think that she has probably read a story that is a gospel story. Mm-hmm. Though not necessarily straight from Scripture, but is still telling that one story that all of our hearts long for and that we have all been created to respond to. And it is worth noting then that the gospel story refreshes your soul. Okay, so she now finds what she's looking for, a spell to make hidden things visible. Even the spell itself has been invisible. But as soon as she starts saying it, it's like stuff starts popping up on the page.
Comes into color.
And when it's done, she realizes that she might have made all sorts of things visible, not just whatever creatures told her to do this. But anything that else is, maybe there's other stuff. Maybe there's things that aren't quite so nice. But I have made all sorts of things potentially
visible.
And she gets that disconcerting sensation that someone has approached from behind her through that open door. She turns and
there's Aslan.
In the flesh. She runs to him with delight and joy and, you know, buries her head in his mane and all that kind of great stuff. And she says that it was so kind of you to come. This has been a pretty traumatic experience for her, even though it's not necessarily been dangerous. Have you ever done an activity that doesn't seem physically taxing at all, but because it's been mentally or emotionally difficult, you get to the end of it and you feel like just exhausted.
Yeah.
You're completely washed out. You know, taking a test or sitting, you know, in an important meeting or going to, you know, talk with someone that you've been estranged from and you've been worried about, and you know, you don't really do much physically, but you get to the end of the day and you're just wiped out. And I kind of get this out of her, you know, oh, Aslan, you knew that I would be exhausted and you have come for me. But what does he say?
I've been here all the time.
I've been here the whole time. You made me visible. How does she respond to that?
Don't make fun of me.
Yeah, she's saying, oh, come on, as though I could do anything and make you do
visible.
But his response is what?
He did. Do you think I wouldn't obey my own rules?
That's right. So again, we have this you know, the nature of God, the natural order, the natural law. These are not controlling God, but he will not go against his own nature, for he is who he is.
I like that. He said that she'd been eavesdropping.
Aha. So he is quite clear. He's been here the whole time, and there is a disappointment in what she's done. Mm-hmm.
But can I go back to where she sees him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then she jumps and holds on to him. It made me think of Eucharist. I mean, he's not visible to us,
mm-hmm.
okay? But then it's like being wrapped in his arms.
Yes, very good.
At Eucharist.
Yeah, not visible, but always there.
Always
yes.
there.
Always there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So even when he says this, there's a little pause, and child, I think you've been eavesdropping. So this is a matter of correction. It's not...
gentle.
It's gentle, but it's firm. It's clear. and she's initially a little bit, you know, it's not like I was hiding and listening to him. It was magic. But is that an excuse? Of course not. However you do it, if you are listening in on a private conversation that does not involve you, through whatever means, you are eavesdropping, you are spying, you are listening to what was not meant for you, and you know it's wrong. And so,
she wants to know if she had done it differently, and then his answer is, you know, you never find out.
You're never going to find what could have happened, because Aslan explains what about the situation. There's a deeper truth still that what she saw was real, but it wasn't everything. What does Aslan reveal about that conversation that her magical eavesdropping could not show her?
That her friend was afraid of the older girl.
Yes.
And it's out of fear that she made the statement.
She's
that she
weak,
made.
But she loves you. You know, this is... this should not be a response of anger. It should be of pity, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, you saw her in a moment of shame. And you have now broken that relationship because of it. Lucy even says, I think I might have spoiled everything.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she did. Maybe they would have been
best friends forever.
But she saw her at this low moment. She judged her. And that judgment, even though now after the fact she realizes was wrong, it doesn't erase the fact that she knows. And it's now changed something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like if you find out something about someone, they don't realize that you know it. It changes something.
Mm-hmm.
And so something is now potentially forever different, and she can regret it, and she can lament it, but it doesn't necessarily change it. So think about for a moment that grace and forgiveness are always here for us, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there are consequences for what we've been forgiven for. I liken it to talking to folks about the temporal versus the eternal. You know, can you be forgiven of any sin? Yes, you can. You know, through murder, the Lord can still restore you to fellowship with Him, and the guilt of your sin will not destroy you. But that's not going to return that other person to life. There's still going to be a family who is missing a family member. There's still going to be a hole where that person ought to be within their homes and neighborhoods, within good they could have done or experienced for the rest of their lives. You may still go to prison. You may still suffer consequences for it, even if we have been forgiven and restored by God. Though eternally, we are back in fellowship with Him, temporally, in this mortal world, there may still be consequences for us to pay.
They gotta pay, yeah. Like that woman who got sentenced to 28 years yesterday.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Oh, the one that killed, I guess she it was a hit and run thing a few months ago. She had a guy who was helping somebody. He was a tow truck driver. And she killed him. She got out of her car, looked at him, got back in the car, and went and played. She went and gambled for the next 11 hours, you know, and her car was damaged, had blood and everything. So the judge was really tough on her. I guess 30 years was she gave her 28 years. But you say she can be restored to...
she can be restored to fellowship with God.
She can be restored to fellowship with the Lord, but this man will never be there for his family.
That's right. It doesn't make... No. It doesn't make everything go away.
No, and so she.
It can redeem it, but it's still the consequences can still be quite real.
Yeah.
I think about something, and this is not sin, but it is to say, to consider for a moment, how lives can be changed in the blink of an eye, that the consequences can be so lasting. A friend's father. And worked at a hospital, and his shifts were often very, very early in the morning while it was still dark. And he was traveling on a dark road to get there, and a suicidal woman had laid down in the road in a dark spot where no one could see her, waiting to be run over. And he was the one who did it. Now, the guilt of that act, though it was not true, he was not the guilty party.
No.
But he could not shake it, and it changed his life forever. He wasn't able to work anymore. Years were spent trying to do anything he could with this overwhelming sense that he caused the death of someone else. Now, he bore no real responsibility for that. He had done nothing wrong. But still, just being involved in something so terrible
affected
him enormously, which then affected his family, which then affected his work, which then affected other people, and on and on and on and on. And these ripples go out to who knows how far and how long for an act that he really bears no guilt for. But it changed everything.
Psychologically, it's something.
So, that is tough news to hear that your sin, while it might be forgiven, and it is, there are still consequences, and it's possible that relationship that she had with her friend will never be the same. She can't know what it could have been, only what it will be. And so in that moment of feeling so responsible and so ashamed and so low, what are Aslan's last words for her?
Well, she wants to know if she's going to be able to read that story again. And he says he will tell her
again,
that story
again
and again. And I think that that's the Lord always...
giving us these moments of closeness that come and go.
And, you know, the story was to refresh her soul, which needed a refreshment right then. And Aslan says, I will tell you this story over and over again. I will tell you in this life over and over again. And in the life to come, I will tell it to you always. And I think that is a just a remarkable and a beautiful vision to conclude a chapter with. So, the actual adventure part of this is still unknown. She's done what she was asked to do by these invisible creatures. We know nothing about them. We don't know how this is all worked out. Are they visible?
Probably.
I bet they are.
I bet they are too.
You know, apparently the spell worked on Aslan, and if it works on Aslan, then why wouldn't it work?
And it worked on the page.
It worked on the page. I have every reason to believe that these invisible creatures are now visible, but she knows nothing of it. So what will happen next is her returning and seeing the consequence
how everything works out.
Of making the invisible visible. All right, so next two chapters next time?
Yeah.
All right, very good, thanks.
Writing them already.